May it please the Court. In March of this year, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case of Padilla v. Kentucky, and they found that ineffective assistance of counsel when the attorney both misadvised and failed to advise his client about the deportation consequences of his guilty plea. They found that that was subject to the Strickland test, not only to the alleged misadvice, but also to any alleged omissions by counsel. And the test that they applied was one that they derived from Strickland as to whether counsel's advice was reasonable under prevailing professional norms. For prevailing professional norms, they looked at the ABA standards and determined that the ABA standards suggested that counsel should advise his client of possible collateral consequences of a guilty plea. They also looked at the NLADA Compendium of Indigent Defense Systems. The direct versus collateral consequences distinction has been an important one in this line of case law. But Padilla instructs that the courts should no longer draw a distinction between direct and collateral consequences.
It doesn't go that far, does it? It says they need not decide whether categorically to reject that test, but in a case where there's such an important and sure consequence, it's really not helpful to look at that. But it can't be categorical.
They did not hold that, Your Honor, that there is no longer a distinction between direct and collateral consequences. But they declined to apply a distinction in the case of deportation.
And they talked at length about how unique deportation was.
That's correct.
So that we cannot interpret their decision as applying across the board to all consequences of a criminal conviction.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. But what they did was, and I think while they professed to apply Strickland and call this the Strickland test and call the prevailing professional norms test an application of Strickland, and in fact that language is out of Strickland, I think that they have expanded that. I mean, I think what they have done is they've made prevailing professional norms more of a sliding scale, more than two distinct analyses of deficient performance and prejudice. Because the way the court applied this with the prevailing professional norms, it makes prejudice almost part of that analysis. Because whether it is reasonable, whether it complies with professional norms to advise a client of particular consequences of a guilty plea is going to depend in part as to whether that plea is brought about because of that advice.
Now, what if the client was a politician? Is the attorney then required to notify the client that they've lost their voting rights if they've been convicted of a felony, or they maybe can't run for office? I mean, how far do these consequences go?
It's always going to be a fact question, Your Honor, and that's one reason why what we've asked for in this case is an evidentiary hearing. But how far those consequences go, I do think, depend on whether it is something that a reasonable attorney would know would impel that guilty plea.
Well, getting back to this one, the consequence was, I guess, the difference between the 40%, which he said his lawyer told him, and 85%.
That's correct, John.
And that's a question of looking at the statute.
And it's a pretty direct consequence if this court wants to draw that distinction, because it is something that's right there in the statute. It follows inexorably. It's not something, as the state suggests, that probation and parole is going to take a look at and decide. You know, it's a real difference when you're talking about how much time am I going to serve? Oh, well, I don't know. Probation and parole is going to apply this complicated formula when you get to prison, and they're going to start with your CR date, and they're going to look at whether how much. This is something that's in the statute. If you commit this form of involuntary manslaughter, you will serve 85%. So if the court wants to draw the distinction between direct and collateral, and I would assert that there collateral consequences.
Well, for example, the defendant can, if he chooses, or the lawyer can, if they choose, because they're published, look at the guidelines of the parole board. Say, well, you're going to spend about a certain amount of time in there. But that's simply a prediction.
That is a prediction. In this case, 85% is an absolute consequence.
Does it matter that we've always treated parole consequences somewhat differently because it's all within the range that you could be sentenced to and you might have to serve? And so you know it's possible you go all the way up to the full length of your sentence. And Is that an important distinction here between deportation, which is truly an additional consequence beyond the sentence?
What Padilla talks about as to whether there is and calls a direct consequence, they use the words automatic result. Mm-hmm. And I think in this circumstance where you do have something that is an automatic result under the statute, it's going to fall under the rule of Padilla.
Do we need to reach all this here, since doesn't your client also allege an affirmative misstatement to him of how long he'd have to serve? And traditionally, we've treated that differently?
Under Padilla makes it clear that the court should no longer distinguish between misadvice and failure to advise. This is a misadvice case, Your Honor, you're correct. And that, and under any analysis.
You're not arguing that means that we should no longer give relief to people who got misadvice, whereas formerly we would have, though, I take it.
No, I think that now the court should make it clear to the lower courts that failure to advise cases fall under the same standard. In fact, Padilla says that outright, that it would lead to absurd results if that distinction continues to be drawn. One of the cases I cited in my brief, the Hayo case, which is a misadvice and was remanded for an evidentiary hearing, I think was interesting because I think it indicates that Missouri is already to a certain extent in this area applying the sliding scale I talked about, because Hayo says erroneous advice can affect the voluntariness of the guilty plea. Well, that's the prejudice analysis. Where there is affirmative misadvice already in Missouri, where there is a failure to advise on direct consequences or collateral consequences that are practically certain to result
But you still have to persuade the finder of fact, the sentencing court.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
If he had been properly advised, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on a trial.
That's something that the movement will have to testify to at an evidentiary hearing. That's the law now, and that will continue to be.
That the lawyer actually gave that advice.
Yes. It is a question of fact.
Is there a dispute about that? That he gave the advice that it was 40%?
I think all of the facts are at issue, Your Honor. There's not been a hearing in this case yet.
If this court were to change its the focus of its analysis to more of a Strickland kind of analysis and whether it was reasonable for the attorney to act as they did and give the advice they did and maybe consider affirmative misadvice as categorically unreasonable, you could look at it that way, what effect would it have on other pending cases? Would there be the floodgates that I know would address somewhat in Padilla? They found there wouldn't be in the deportation context. But would there be a floodgate of cases that would open up should this court accept your argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if it violates prevailing professional norms to fail to advise a client of consequences that are going to follow from a guilty plea, registration requirements, sexually violent predator possibilities.
Loss of your driver's license because points are assessed in a traffic violation?
If it's something
that's certain to happen, we know that's certain to happen. So why in all those cases when somebody pleads guilty to speeding and they didn't know about those consequences, would all those pleas be subject to being set aside?
If it violates prevailing professional norms not to advise of those things, then I would hope attorneys are doing that already.
How would you define that? I mean, how would you write the opinion? Where do you draw all the boundaries?
I would draw the boundaries so that if it impels the guilty plea, and if a reasonable attorney acting under similar circumstances knows that my client will not plead guilty if he knows he's going to do 85%, but if he knows he's going to be subject to registration.
Let me interrupt you, though, because in Padilla they had written authority that they relied on as to what the prevailing professional norms were. And that they said those universally required advising a client of the deportation consequences. So what prevailing professional norms do you have to tell us what are the norms that are required? That you're saying that those norms include any known consequence. So,
sure.
So what is your authority for that?
The ABA standard says counsel should advise of possible collateral consequences. That's
so
pretty broad.
So you're saying all possible, as opposed to, I thought Padilla, deportation was important because it was an almost sure consequence of it. And now you're saying all possible collateral would really broaden it to almost anything.
I think it's going to be a fact question, Your Honor.
And but what do you, I think the question was, what are you relying on? In Padilla, they looked at the ABA standards, all sorts of other standards. They all said advising someone of possible deportation consequences is required for competent assistance, basically, and you should do that. Are there standards here that say you have to advise of mandatory minimum time that you have to serve?
The NLAD Compendium of Indigent Defense Systems does have certain states that require that. Oregon is one of them. I think I cited that in my brief.
Well, should the trial judge be required in every case where the 85% applies to advise the defendant?
That's not currently the law, Your Honor. I don't think it's a bad idea. It's something that's in the statute. I certainly think reasonably competent counsel should advise of that, and I think it is ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to do that, and it has already been held to be ineffective assistance of counsel to misadvise.
Would it be good to have a nexus between, you're talking about time that the person is going to serve, whether it's going to be 40% or 85%, versus a collateral consequence? We had a case, I think, where a juvenile had some drug paraphernalia, and he loses his driver's license. He had no idea he was going to lose his driver's license, but we call that a collateral consequence. It's not the same as when you're pleading guilty to a crime, what time you're going to serve. It's critical to know whether it's 40% or 85%.
It is critical. It's going to impel the guilty plea. There are lines going to be drawn. The Georgia case, the Taylor case I cited in my brief, drew a line between registration as a sex offender and treatment as a sex offender. The court held that treatment was far enough out on the collateral consequences sliding scale, if you will, that it was not held to be ineffective to fail to advise that you were going to have to be treatment.
In Padilla, the consequence of deportation in effect extended a sentence for the defendant. Your opponent is distinguishing this case and saying that the amount of time you serve your sentence is not an extension of the sentence and therefore is not the same type of consequence. Can you answer that?
Only to say that that's not what Padilla was decided on. They didn't decide because it was something extraneous. That almost makes it seem more collateral. This is something that's almost more direct because it is a type of the
same. Has Padilla been extended? I know it's a fairly recent case. Has it been extended to any fact situation beyond deportation by the U.S. Supreme Court?
The Georgia case I cited is extended Padilla in that case to sex offender registration. There's an 11th Circuit case, but I don't think I cited it in my brief, that extended it to sexually violent predator, and I can supplement that if the court is interested.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
There's an 11th Circuit case, Bauder, B-A-U-D-E-R, that extended Padilla to a sexually violent predator commitment. But it's not cited in the brief.
May it please the court? There is one and only one question that this court needs to answer in order to resolve appellant's claims. And that question is, did the motion court clearly err when it found that appellant's allegations were refuted by the record? It's the only question this court needs to answer. But because of appellant's failure to compile a complete record, this court is unable to answer that question. The appellant essentially asked this court to find that the motion court clearly erred in holding that the record refuted his claim without providing the court with the entire record that the motion court relied upon.
But you recognize that the general statements, no promises were made. I know you recognize this court has held are not enough to contradict a specific claim that no promises is different than saying you will serve, you will not have to serve 85% or you will serve 40%.
I'm not aware that this court has said that. I know that the Missouri appellate courts have said that. There might be.
But this court in Driver and other cases said you cannot rely on this little litany of five questions to say nothing outside it counts.
Well,
it's very clear.
And many of the lower courts have distinguished Driver because Driver was about, first of all, it was a case where someone did not waive their rights to counsel, where they asserted their rights to counsel and proceeded to trial. And the issue that Driver raised, she raised her counsel's failure to call an expert witness, which I think most lower courts have distinguished 24035 cases because, first of all, the person has waived counsel, and second of all, that's an issue that you wouldn't normally expect a defendant to understand or to know that his lawyer should have done.
Isn't your argument completely contrary to our cases, whether still valid or not, saying that affirmative misrepresentations provide a basis for relief?
No, but my argument's not opposed to that. No, I haven't.
Because you're saying litany no promises were made automatically means you don't get a raise of post-conviction claim.
Well, my position is that first of all, that is not the only thing in the record that demonstrates that refutes his claim. But it does refute his claim in that you would expect that if parole eligibility was a concern of Mr. Webb's, if that's why he decided to plead guilty, that when he was standing before the trial court and he was asked, has any other promises been made to you in order to induce this guilty plea other than the state's recommendation, that you would have expected affirmative response from the defendant at that point.
Well, you're assuming that information regarding sentence is the same as a promise, which is not necessarily the case.
Well, to the extent that he was given information about parole eligibility, to the extent that he was given advice about it.
The promise, advice and a promise can be very different things, can they not?
They can. And to the extent that he was given advice or a prediction about what his parole eligibility would be,
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Then I don't think he can claim that induced his guilty plea. I mean, it needs to be something that he depended on, that it was a promise. If it was put forward as advice about this is what I think that your parole eligibility
and
will
that gets, and we're not talking about here, I think you're probably going to serve 3 years or 5 years because you're going to have good behavior or bad behavior or whatever. There's a minimum, 85%. It's not a prediction. It's not a promise. It's in the law. He cannot get out until he served at least 85%. And that's what this case is about.
Well, I think parole eligibility is a mixed bag. I mean, this entire issue is a mixed bag. On the
well,
one
it's
hand.
It's not a mixed bag for this particular guy because he's got an 85%. They don't even consider him until 85%. He's got to be inside for 85%.
It's a mixed bag because he may serve all 12 years. There's no guarantee that he will serve that 85%.
But he will serve at least 85%.
But again, we're talking about in any parole eligibility case, we're talking about eligibility, whether or not he'll actually be released.
That's automatic that he gets 85%.
That is automatic.
So
he gets at least 85%. It's not automatic that he'll be released.
When you're talking about the record, it being incomplete, I assume you're referring to the sentencing assessment report.
I am.
And the sentencing assessment report is not, however, part of the trial court's record, is it?
It is.
But was it a part of the motion court's record?
It was. It was. And for three reasons. First of all, at sentencing, it was referenced in sentencing, and I'm sure you recall from the brief that it was talked about at sentencing. It was noted that the defendant had gone over the SAR with his attorney. At that point, he was given an opportunity to withdraw his guilty plea because the trial court intended to not go along with, not follow the sentencing recommendation and to exceed it. And he reaffirmed his decision to plead guilty at that point. The motion court referred to the SAR and its findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now,
why is all this an issue for remand for an evidentiary hearing on whether or not he reasonably he knew about this consequence?
Well, because that SAR is relevant to this appeal.
Right.
It was in the record. The motion court also sat as the sentencing court. It was the same
but
judge.
But it's not necessarily true that he would have seen the sentencing assessment report.
The record indicates that he did. The record indicates that he saw it and that he went over it with his attorney before reaffirming his decision to plead guilty.
How does the record reflect that?
On
is
page.
That, is that in the transcript?
It is in the transcript.
Page. Now, is there a specific reference to the part about in the sentencing assessment report about the percentage of time you're expected to serve?
There is in the sentencing assessment report.
There is. But I mean, is there a specific reference to it in the transcript about going over it? Going over it means, I assume it's a fairly
not that lengthy
specific
report. Issue that they went over it, presumably in its entirety. There's no reason to think that they only went over portions of it.
Counsel, it's my understanding that you sought to supplement the record with that, and the trial court said it wasn't part of the record and wouldn't certify it up.
I asked for a certified copy from the court reporter, and their concern was the statute, which is.
On pre-sentence investigations.
On pre-sentence investigations that says that the information that the defendant has provided to the parole officer or the probation officer is privileged information.
Well, how can you tell us that counsel, that defendant has waived this issue by not presenting us with a report which cannot be, at least the trial court believes, cannot be part of the record? I mean, that seems rather catch-22.
Well, there was an alternative way to get it into the record, and that is that the appellant was asked to stipulate to that document because the court the
and it's a waiver if they won't stipulate to something that's not in the that's not in the appellate record and can't be that.
Because it's relevant information. This is an issue that I think the circuit clerk was incorrect about. There are other circuit clerks that don't feel the same way. Torrance, which is cited in the is a case from the Eastern District that's cited in the motion court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, references actually that an SAR refuted a movement's claim.
Can you address Padilla and its effect on our analysis of these cases?
I can.
Before you do, real quickly, in regards to this SAR report, you stated in your brief that maybe it might be necessary to remand this for an evidentiary hearing. Are you conceding that point?
I'm not. No.
But what did you mean by that in your brief?
Well, I think to the extent that my position is that the SAR is part of the record, and I recognize this court might not agree with that, or at least that it should be part of the record. For a court to consider it, for a court to say it's been filed with this court and to hear it, and then to get this strange position from the circuit clerk that it's not part of the record, I'm unclear about what to do with that. It seems like it clearly was part of the record, that it was considered by the court, and that it should be part of the record. And so, to the extent that it's not, then this court would decide that it's not, then perhaps we do need to.
Well, if the trial court mentioned it and it referred to it in its findings and conclusions, how could it not be part of the record?
That's exactly my question. I don't understand that. And I think it is sort of one clerk's interpretation of this statute, which does have a whole bunch of exceptions about, you know, that the state is entitled to have access to the SAR. The judge who is obviously entitled to have it. It would seem that this court, in reviewing the trial court's decision, should be entitled to have it.
Let's assume for the moment that the SAR was in this record, mm-hmm. and that it had a statement in there that if you have certain prior convictions, because he has certain prior convictions, he would have to serve 85%. Mm-hmm. Then that would be your view that conclusively refutes his claim that he didn't know with that, or would it, you also have to show that he actually read that, and then how would his counsel's affirmative misadvice affect that?
It would at the very least at that point refute the necessary part of his claim that he reasonably relied on some sort of misrepresentation by counsel.
So he should believe this report versus his counsel's affirmative misstatement?
Well, his specific claim is that that counsel told him that he'd only have to do 40% because he only had one prior prison commitment. The SAR would reveal that's not true. So it might very well be the case that if he did get bad information from his attorney, bad advice, it was because he provided erroneous and false information to his lawyer. And that's why the advice came back incorrect, if any of that's even true.
Do you have the transcript right there at the podium where they talk about what he and his lawyer discussed relative to the SAR?
It's on page 17 of the legal file. Where the court says the SAR has been completed and filed with the court, asked the state if they had a chance to review it. They said yes. Asked plea counsel if she'd had an opportunity to review it. She said yes, and then said, have you had a chance to discuss it with your client? And she said, yes, I have. And that's
so the question was, have you discussed it with your client?
Right, that's the record of it. So and I would expect that the most important thing in an SAR to a defendant when he sits down to look at that would be what the probation officer sentencing recommendation would be, followed very closely thereafter by the parole guidelines. And so I would expect that if he'd gone over it with his attorney that he would have.
But that's an assumption, not something that's known from the record.
I mean, why isn't that, aren't these factual issues that the state may well win on if there's a hearing? But that there needs to be a hearing to find out, did counsel in fact discuss this with him? And if you look at the Hill case, which is referenced in Padilla, Hill v. Lockhart, one reason they found no ineffective assistance in failing to, the U.S. Supreme Court, in failing to discuss parole considerations is that counsel was unaware of prior convictions of his client and therefore didn't know he'd have to serve a minimum. But if here you're saying the SAR showed these priors and so counsel should have known, doesn't that actually support defendant's claim of ineffective assistance and not telling him that he'd have to serve 85% when it showed right there that he had these priors?
Well, it might have support. The issue is that there's no indication in the record anywhere that plea counsel would have had access to the SAR.
Well, and I'm not trying to resolve that right now. My point is, isn't that what a hearing's for, to deal with all these issues and get them figured out?
I think at this point the record's clear enough. I think that this court, to the extent that his claim that he no other promises had been made is insufficient, it still supports the conclusion that he hadn't received any other promises. It might not conclusively decide the issue, but I think that supports it. And I think when you take that together with the SAR and the presumptions that we need to make about the SAR, since it's not in the record,
well, you don't want us to conduct a hearing on it, do you?
This court, no, this Your Honor.
You haven't had a chance to address the larger legal issue about the effect of Padilla looking at the issue, saying at least in terms of deportation that it's ill-suited to consideration as to whether it's direct or collateral. It doesn't easily fall into either, and it's unnecessary to determine that or to decide if that distinction has any continued validity, because regardless, any competent counsel would have told him about it.
Well, and the threshold issue there, that I'll touch upon just briefly because I touched upon it in the brief, is that this case doesn't present those claims. He never alleged that counsel failed to advise him. He alleged affirmative misadvice. So it's not really proper to ask this court to go and expand.
But Padilla does address that too and says that omission is just as bad as commission, and a failing to tell someone about an important consequence is just as incompetent as affirmatively not telling them, because otherwise you're going to encourage counsel, which in fact it does, to remain silent rather than risk misadvising.
It does. My concern is applying Padilla to a specific factual situation that Padilla didn't address.
Have to do, so we'd like your advice on how.
And I will.
And it is a problem. I mean, I agree how you apply it in the different contexts.
As you mentioned before, Judge Schiff, there are three reasons. Well, you've mentioned the first of them as to why we shouldn't completely get rid of the direct versus collateral distinction, why that's still important. First of all, because Padilla explicitly declined to do that. Second of all, because there was many mentions of Padilla about why deportation is.
But in effect, didn't they, by saying whatever it's called, deportation is something that has to be advised about, they've said you can't just categorically say indirect consequences don't have to be advised about and direct do, that kind of stark, bright line analysis simply doesn't apply to things like deportation, which are an important and sure consequence of pleading guilty, even if it's helpful. And they didn't say it can't be helpful otherwise, but deportation itself, that if they decided it without deciding which category it was, clearly that's not an answer in and of itself.
It might not be the definitive sort of way of resolving the issue that it used to be. But I would point out that of the four reasons why the court decided that deportation was an important consequence, two of them very closely relate to the old definition of what a direct collateral direct consequence is. One, that it's intimately related to the criminal process and it flows automatically from conviction. The old definition of direct consequences, which I know was used a lot in federal cases, I'm not sure if there's a Missouri case, which are direct consequences are those which flow definitely, immediately, and largely automatically from the entry of a guilty plea. That definition is found in the Maxwell case, which is the Eastern District case that declined to apply Padilla to civil commitment.
This is kind of new because Padilla is so new.
It is.
I have a case from the Court of Appeals in Kentucky, which is the court that Padilla came out of, so I guess maybe it's a once-burned, twice-shy court, but it's exactly on fours with this point, and that is they remanded for an evidentiary hearing on post-conviction relief where there was an allegation by the defendant that he had been misadvised by counsel and would not have pleaded guilty otherwise as to parole eligibility. So it really is interesting. It's Pridham versus the Commonwealth of Kentucky. It was, I think, about a week or so ago.
Well, and I'll see. I'm out of time.
Yeah, obviously.
But I did want to address.
I'd be happy to hear from you in a letter about whether that's distinguishable or what, but because I'm kind of, you're kind of sandbagged because it was only a few, like a week ago.
Well, I think I've implicitly, if not explicitly, conceded that that Mr. Webb established a prima facie case of ineffective assistance of counsel in his motion. In other words, if everything in his motion were true, I don't think I would have an argument that he would not be entitled to relief. And so the first thing that he needs to do in order to be entitled to an evidentiary hearing, he's successfully done that. The second thing, which is to state things that are not conclusively refuted by the record, I don't think that he's done that. And for that reason, I would ask this court to confirm.
So what you really focused on here is not that he's not shown ineffective assistance of counsel and that it is a matter that would otherwise have a hearing unless it's refuted by the record, and that's really where your focus is that it, in this case it's refuted by the record. Is that a fair
exactly.
summary of your, okay, thank you.
Thank you, it's a lot of tough questions in a first argument. You did very nicely.
Yes, thank you.
I do just want to briefly mention the SAR in the motion court's findings. It's mentioned in the fact findings in the procedural history of the case that there was one. The conclusions of law, however, focus on that promises were, that movement said there were no promises made doesn't mention the SAR there.
In Padilla, when it gets around to what you actually have to do to satisfy your constitutional requirements, it specifically says to satisfy the responsibility, we now hold that counsel must inform her client whether his plea carries a risk of deportation. Okay. Now, that's a lot less than these ABA norms that you're citing. In other words, what if counsel honestly said, you know, I really don't know based upon your case and what you're pleading guilty to, but you have a risk of serving your entire sentence regardless of your parole eligibility. Is that enough?
In the facts of this case, where 85% is in the statute, I don't think it's enough, Your Honor. In a case where
Padilla, they said you got to tell them that there's a risk of deportation.
You do, and I think Justice Alito's concurrence is more, the more interesting of it, because Alito seems to say that the majority has put too high a burden on counsel, although he concurred in the judgment, says that, you know, nobody can figure out this deportation law unless you're an INS attorney. So you can't make poor criminal attorneys sort all this out. You have to tell them is that there is some risk that you're going to be deported.
If you plead guilty to a crime and you're subject to deportation, that's, you know, it's pretty basic.
I think that's the essential question, Your Honor. I think the question is whether you would plead guilty if you knew about these consequences, whether we call them collateral or direct.
The majority said it's just not, we can't always have bright line tests, even though they're a lot easier, and that it's clear under immigration law that this guy was going to get deported if he pled guilty here, and so he had to tell him. And that's ineffective and doesn't rise to the level expected of counsel. In other circumstances where the law is less clear, and of course criminal attorneys are not experts in immigration law, it may be a question of fact as to whether they should have, and you can't categorically say one way or the other, but your argument here was that the 85% is like the Padilla and that it is automatic. There's nothing unsure about the statute or unclear.
That's right, Your Honor. I wish I could give you all a bright line test that I was asserting, but I don't think there is one. I think it's a sliding scale, and I think Justice Alito was right. He calls this a dramatic expansion of the scope of defense counsel's duties under the Sixth Amendment. I think the Supreme Court has changed the Strickland test, whether they meant to or not, and made it a lot less easy to apply, frankly. It's not going to be a case of deficient performance over here and prejudice over here. I think it's going to depend, and one is going to influence the other a lot more than it did.
Do you dispute whether or not the SAR was a part of the motion court's record below?
I do dispute that, Your Honor. It's not in the docket sheets. The circuit clerk will not provide it. I didn't have a copy until I got it from the assistant attorney general.
Both the state and the defense and the trial court had it at the time of sentencing.
At the time of sentencing.
How can it not be a part of the record?
It's not before
you're
the motion court.
You're saying it just wasn't made. Maybe there was a mistake here. It wasn't made a part, or are you
saying
these, it can't
these
be?
Clerks won't provide them in a lot of counties, Your Honor.
Your opponent says that your client made a prima facie record, but it's been refuted by the record. If we don't have the whole record here, how can we make our decision?
I think that there's got to be an evidentiary hearing on this matter. We don't know what was before the motion court. We don't know what the movement was told by his attorney. The reference in the guilty plea transcript is, yes, we reviewed it.
But you know the SAR was before.
So it's, if it's in the SAR and you say, well, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? That'd be my counsel might say.
Okay.
Do you think it's conclusive against you?
The SAR does say
the 85%.
Okay. So should I believe that or should I believe what my lawyer told me?
I don't think it's in the record, Your Honor.
Right?
I don't think it's in the record.
What if it were in the record? On the remand, if it's in the record for the motion court, what does that mean if it says that in there?
I think the question becomes, does it have to be in the record that that he was told it'd be 85%. That's not in the guilty plea transcript.
But the sentencing judge and the motion court judge were the same person. Does that have any bearing?
But how can we hold the movement to know for sure that he's going to serve 85% when he wasn't told that in open court? Well, I mean, it's like if it had been a guilty plea petition where he'd signed it, then that's been held to refute his claims.
Was there anything in the record about whether he can read and write?
I don't recall.
But didn't the transcript that your opponent read indicate that the counsel did discuss with the client the terms of the SAR report that you just now said included 85%?
Not specifically what we're...
We don't know what he discussed.
We don't know what was discussed.
Doesn't there have to be some kind of formal proceeding or process to make something part of the record? Like the SAR?
Well, in a post-conviction case, the criminal file is part of the record.
Right. If the trial judge takes judicial notice of the file before most, if there was a hearing,
that's often done at a hearing. Sure.
If he had a hearing, he'd take. That's the first thing he would do.
This will be made part of the record easily at an evidentiary hearing.
But right now, it's not in the record.
It's not.
Even if it should have been, it was not made part.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is taken under submission.